It's Monday, November 22nd, 2010, and you're listening to episode 212 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 15 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
And my name is Chris.
And my name is Tracy.
Hot. Joining us again is the hottest chick in role playing, Tracy Hickman.
I thank you. Thank you very much.
I like chicks with a deep voice.
Chad's into East Germans and Hickmans. That actually may be a German name.
Yeah, I believe actually it was at one point. But then we crossed the English Channel and changed it.
So we're bringing Tracy back as a guest host because some subjects we want to cover that we believe he is uniquely positioned to speak on. But before we get to that, Tracy, there is something I have to ask you because there is a... I guess we'll call it an urban legend within gamers, and I have to find out if it's true or not.
Well, you keep referencing this urban legend, and I've never heard of it.
I have no clue what you're talking about.
Is this
either.
When you wake up after a session of D&D in a tub full of ice?
Why doesn't my back
hurt? Your dice are missing, and there's two scars on your chest.
No, it's the
there's
other
a ring
one.
Around your mouth and a quarter.
Well, I'll be happy to clarify any of that for you.
I thought Gaming with Pat was bad.
Because, yes, I was there.
So, all right, no, you guys say you've never heard this, which is completely fair. But I did not invent this. I have heard this from several other people who completely swear it is true, like all urban legends.
Yes,
and so I'm taking this straight back to the source. Tracy, the story goes that back during the days when you guys were writing the Dragonlance novels, that despite the fact that Margaret actually was a woman, and despite the name Tracy, obviously you are not, you received several propositions and she did not. Is there any truth to that story?
Well, I can't speak to necessarily whether she did not, but I did. I think my favorite was the letter that came in from a young man who said that I was the only woman who understood him.
Wow, Job was writing letters back then?
I was invited to be a guest speaker at a women's conference.
Nice.
That's so awesome.
Did you
nearly
accept?
Went, actually. I tried to, but I think however my favorite happened in Gurnee, Illinois, when Margaret and I were at a Barnes & Noble there doing a book signing. And a young man came up to the table, walked up to Margaret, and I was sitting next to her, and he walked up to Margaret and said, "Where's Tracy? Couldn't she be here today?"
Wow.
And I said, "No."
Why Dash Zero? You sell fantasy. Why change that now?
Why change that now? And actually, it is true that I did get a number of people who were really disappointed after they met me. I was greatly concerned, though, when the propositions continued to come after my picture was put in the back of the book.
They just changed tone a little bit, that's all.
Yeah, those are the ones who are like, yeah, that's okay. You know, whatever.
Okay. Thank you.
It's California close.
Yeah, write to me at the office. That'll be fine. Thank you.
You just close your eyes and imagine it, kind of. You know.
But no, that's true. I did. A lot of people thought I was the only female D&D writer at the time, and was quite popular for that.
Nice.
Actually, Ravenloft, of course, was one of the best pieces of work that my wife and I had done and did together. And after Ravenloft, we became known as the Hickman Sisters.
Hickman Sisters.
I remember you on the USO tours with Bob Hope. It was always very entertained.
That's right. I usually sang the low part. And yeah,
Chris saw those in the original black and white too. So
right.
The world actually was in black and white back in Chris's day.
It was
not just on film.
No, it was
amazing.
All of our military uniforms were in black and white, and we fought the Germans in black and white. And
yep.
Yeah, that was when war was war. We need to go back to black and white.
And he's actually talking about the Kaiser, not the Third Reich.
I'm talking about the Great War. I don't know what you're winning.
Yeah.
All right, so let's lead off here. We got a bunch of things we want to talk about here.
Oh, let's talk about all of them.
And let's see how many we can pack into one show. Nothing on that, Pat? All right, so let's start off with this.
We've been letting things fly by the entire time. We have a guest. So I don't want to be too rude right up front. So
yeah, but he's already been on one show. He's all broke in for you.
We've broken his cherry. Yeah, we've popped cherry already. So it's all good.
All right, so let's start off with this one. Tracy, you said you had an announcement, and I don't even know.
I wanted to tell you guys about something that I'm very excited about. I'm about to start here in not too long. And, you know, keep it under your hats. I really don't want it to get out of the bag very far.
So just a secret between us and all the listeners.
All the more reason to put it on a podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I mean, this is a very tight community we have here.
This will not.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I've been working on this for quite some time, and it's finally coming to fruition here. I'm just signed a contract with DC Comics. I'm going to be doing a Batman novel.
I was going to say two Batman. Yes. That's awesome.
Huh. We were expecting, you know, an interesting announcement. That's like a jaw-dropping announcement.
Yeah, back up here.
Yeah, that's
first off, if I kill you, am I next in line? I just want to get this out of the way because I do have to ask.
Does this have anything to do with the most recent storyline that's sort of hit the news with Batman and the fact that Bruce Wayne has come out and said that he funds Batman and that he is going to make an army of Batmans across the world?
What are you talking about?
No, he's completely true.
Yeah, no, that was like this week.
That's true.
Yeah, and that was a real
And
nice
I also
one.
Want to make clear that I don't seem to have any affiliation with the Batman stage play that's going to be coming out here shortly.
There's already a great foretaste of a Batman musical in an episode of Batman Beyond.
Quite true. Actually, the story that I'm going to be writing with DC is about Batman's father. And, it is a great story about Batman discovering what actually happened in his father's life, which is a lot different, I think, than people think.
I'm actually really glad to hear it doesn't have anything to do with the comic books coming out right now. Because with Grant Morrison writing, I think I'd enjoy it better if it didn't have connection to it.
I've always been a huge fan of Batman. What an incredible character. It's going to be a real challenge to get inside that particular head. I can tell you one thing, I think definitively, about the book that's coming, and that is that there will be no dragons in it.
Batman, Dragon Knight. Are you going to throw in just a left-handed sort of side reference?
A dragon tattoo?
I think like a dragon tattoo, or like they go into the dragon bar,
there'll be a Chinese festival, and there'll be, Chinese New Year. And there'll be, people in the dragon.
Are you going to throw in anything like that?
Yes.
All right. So I've got.
No, I don't. I don't know. It's going to be. I'm very excited about it in terms of the story itself, because the story looks very closely and intimately at the roots of the Batman legend. It takes a look at Martha Wayne. Mm-hmm. Who actually, if you take a look at the history of the comic books, is a really unusual character. I mean, she was a party girl in her day. As the history has evolved, Bruce's father is not entirely the White Knight, I think, that everybody has made him out to be. That certainly Bruce has made him out to be. Daddy's got secrets, and in some ways, I believe that Dad has not only sown the seeds of what Bruce became in Batman, but the problems that drove Gotham to require that Batman be Batman. It's a beautiful, dark, chocolate, noir kind of a tale.
So are you a regular follower of the comic books or just a fan of the character in general?
I'm a fan of the character in general, I think, is probably safer to say. I look at the history of Batman and people used to complain to me about the continuity of Dragonlance. The Dragonlance background is perfectly clear compared to Batman's backstory and back history, which has been so checkered by everything, from the multiverse to just who, depending on who is writing him at the moment.
I got to say, you surprised me on this one, because when we were talking back in the interview, I asked you about a return to RPGs. And you said, well, I have an announcement I'm holding on to and really excited to make. And so I figured this was going to be returned to RPGs. I don't think if I was standing at the gates of heaven and somebody said to get in, you have to tell me what Tracy Hickman's about to do, I would spend the rest of eternity in limbo. I don't think I ever would have guessed this. So
I thought you were going to announce that you're getting a sex change.
I thought that too, Chris, but I didn't say it.
I'm thinking that's what's going to be coming out of his mouth. And no, it's totally, totally out of left field.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad you're back. But there's just, I've got to ask them, How does one go about landing a Batman novel? I mean, obviously, anyone.
Hold on, I want
to
take notes on this.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say, because is this just idle curiosity?
I know all about how you go out there and put crappy fanfic on the web. I know all about even how you go about getting a legitimate book published in a variety of ways. Traditional ways, new media ways, blah, blah, blah. And we're going to come back to that in a moment. But what is the process by which someone gets in line to write a Batman novel?
I don't know quite where that line is. And to be truthful with you, I'm not entirely sure how it is I came to this particular place.
The day approached you.
You guys are the first people are going to admit that if you look at me and think about the work that I've done in the past and think, oh, you know what? The next thing he's going to do, obviously predictable, he's going to do a Batman novel. But I think it becomes, in many ways, a confluence of wonderful intentions. I've got a great agent in New York, Matt Bialer, who's stuck by me through thick and thin, and lately it's been pretty thin for everybody. But he's a fabulous, dynamic man who is committed to the genre and committed to the work.
So what, did he just phone DC or
and he knows the guys over
Bob Kane?
No. What he did is he put the Tracy Hickman symbol on the big light, shown it at night. He had to wait for a cloudy night.
So there was like a dragon in light over Chicago.
It looks like those that silhouette of the chick
light and made the symbol myself.
Nice.
I envision it. It's like the truckers, you know, mud flats. It's like the reclining chick, the silhouette of the chick, you know, because, you know. Is that what that is?
No, seriously. So did they approach you? Did you approach them?
My agent said, what interests you? What would you like to do? And I said,
Batman.
I did do Batman. He said, he came to me. He says, you know, I've been thinking about what to do because truthfully, he came to me and he said, you know, fantasy's dead here. People are not buying it, but then nobody's buying anything. And I had a couple of really solid, exciting projects that were out there, but they weren't getting any play because no one was buying anything. And he said to me, you know, is there something that might be different that you might like to do? You know, I've known some guys over at DC. I said, well, you know, there's this Batman guy. And I could do some really great stuff with that. And the editors over there were really great and receptive to our ideas. They actually sent me the encyclopedia for Batman, which was a superb help and a great resource. And now we're set to go. And
you put that Batman DC encyclopedia up on BitTorrent, right?
So I'm curious, whenever you take on a franchise as big as Batman, what are sort of some of the challenges you find there? I mean, is it intimidating to work with that? Are they sort of draconic in their treatment of how you approach?
Did you ask that whole question just to set up a pun?
Actually, I did. It just sort of rolled off the tongue there whenever I got to it. But
scale it back a little.
Yeah, when they're looking at that intellectual property. I mean, what experiences have you had with this so far?
Actually, it's been a tremendous experience so far because everybody over at DC has been so fabulously supportive of what I would like to do. And I'm used to working in a collaborative environment anyway. And so the initial story that I brought into them was very much oriented strictly on the story of Batman's father rather than, you know, they came back to me and they said, you know, this is a really cool story, but we can't really have a Batman novel without Batman in the novel here, you know. And so I revised that and took like, well, yeah, that makes sense to me. So we did a revision on that and came up with just an amazing storyline that, you know, that really is very much, I think, true to the essence of what Batman has become in our minds. An individual who's, to a certain extent, tortured by his past and may have difficulty coming to grips with the idea that the past isn't what he thought it was.
So two things here I want to ask you. One is, what's a really loose time frame on this? I mean, is this a novel we're going to see next year, 2 years from now?
Yeah. Do you have a release date? Because when it comes out, we want to read it and tell you if you've
pushed the character.
Exactly.
Is this on the Chinese democracy release schedule?
I may actually have to go to Comic-Con now, huh? I'm going to be writing the book this spring. And it's on a quick schedule because they'd like to have it out for winter of next year.
And it is just a single novel?
Yeah. Being me, of course, I originally proposed three. But but they said, couldn't you do it in, like, one? And I said, okay, Yeah, sure. We'll see how that goes.
Good luck on that. I'll tell you right now, if I was writing it, I'd open up a Word document, write three words. I'm writing Batman. And that is as far as the project would ever get.
Actually, you're wrong. It goes to four. Actually, it's I'm writing Batman, dude. It's a very, very exciting project for me. I can't tell you, not just to be able to tell a story in the universe of Batman, not just to be able to be a part of a character that's that iconic, but to tell this particular story. It really reaches me to be able to do this, and I'm just super excited about the whole project.
Wow. Okay. So I thought this was going to be a quick 2-minute hit. Oh, yeah. I had no idea.
You got
me on a.
Dan was like,
I didn't see
Tracy
this one coming.
Hickman, blah blah blah, dragons, another dragon.
Yeah, wait a minute. Did you say Batman? Game,
yeah. He dropped the atom bomb.
Afraid I'm going to have to come back, of course, when we get in the middle of writing this and tell you how things are going.
We'd love to have you on it.
Yeah, if you want to come back on here and talk about Batman, anytime.
Chapters, you know, that kind of thing.
I'll tell you this little tiny story. Last Christmas, one of the things I put on my Christmas list was
Batman.
With Batman.
And you got him. You bitch.
I got him. One of the things I wanted was, I think it's a Matchbox version of the Tumbler, the Batmobile tank. And so I have promised myself, for being a good boy and getting a Batman contract, that I was going to buy myself this toy.
Wow. Justly deserved, sir. Justly awesome. Deserved. That is great news.
All right, so we got...
Where do you go from there?
You've gone from the guy who made a living writing RPG novels to a guy who's writing Batman. I mean, just when you thought something couldn't get bigger than Unicron, it does. So, all right, we've got several things we want to talk about, including we want to get to an RPG advice topic here that I'd love to get Tracy's take on. And we've got some ideas on as well, and we'll just see how we do on time. But before we get to that, I want to do a little bit of a follow-up on some topics we talked about in the interview. Specifically, I want to talk about prose and game publishing, because one of the themes that's come up a lot in the course of this show, obviously we're sympathetic to it ourselves being a new media outlet, is the fact that media in general is in a state of transition. And with Chris, of course, working at NBC, we've talked about things like the shift of television from appointment entertainment to on-demand entertainment, whatnot. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is occurring right now is prose writing, like all other forms of media, is in a state of flux, and I think it has a somewhat uncertain future. People look at where things are right now. Nobody has any problem saying, yes, something isn't working out, but there's a lot of ideas on where to go from here. And Tracy, with your current endeavor with Eventide, the whole Dragon's Bard series, as a guy who has a well-established track record in print media, you know, the very traditional way of doing things, have now tried a run into audio media, PDF distribution, moving away from what really looks like even mass distribution down to almost what I would describe as a patronage model, where you get a smaller number of higher paying fans as opposed to a larger number of lower paying fans. And I'm curious, how is this going for you? What are you learning? What portents do you see in this that will affect prose publishing, game publishing, all the things that we and our audience and you as well are interested in?
I was watching Barack Obama on, I think it was on 60 Minutes the other day, and the interviewer was asking him, why was it that he was on The View? Why was he on The Daily Show? Why go to these popcorn media outlets? Isn't that demeaning to the presidency? That was the question. And his answer I thought was very interesting. He said it used to be in the old days that when the president had an announcement, he would call a press conference and the three major broadcast systems would show up and he'd make his announcement and they'd all carry it and everyone would know it. But that's no longer the case. There are people who just watch The Daily Show. I mean, that's where they get their news because they're so tired of the yammering that they're getting from everybody else. And it doesn't matter whether it's from CNN or whether it's from Fox or from MSNBC. It doesn't matter. There are so many other voices that are clamoring for their attention that the old days of where you could just simply take out your commercial on one of the big three networks and expect your message to get out there are gone. And that's true in print publishing. It used to be that what you would do is you would go in and you would print an enormous number of books and you'd flood the bookstores with them and you'd have huge stacks of books in the front of the bookstore, which would somehow convince people coming into the bookstore that this must be an important book. Otherwise, they wouldn't have ordered all these books. You know, when in fact, we're just stripping a lot of covers at this point and essentially making a lot of fireworks in China. And this is true. This was actually explained to me by one of the publishers that the one of the biggest problems in publishing is that the market in China for shredded paper had gone bad, and it was making a huge impact on American publishing.
I would have never put that together.
Yeah, the connections you never make.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And so we find ourselves in a time where new media has challenged all of that, and where even the way we view things has changed. The whole VTR idea, the TiVo, that where you can flex time your television viewing, and where you can tape two shows at the same time and then watch them whenever, which skews the demographics and skews all of the rating systems. But it's not just that. We have so many voices that are clamoring for attention right now, and so many places to go, so much noise in our life that it's uncomfortable for young people when it's quiet, and reflection is a difficult thing for them.
So how exactly does this pan out in terms of what you're doing? Is the idea
interestingly enough that it pans out much better than you would expect? I did an article online that I called "The Few Hundred" for the subscribers of our book. And I told them in this article that The Lord of the Rings, which is one of the biggest read English-speaking books in English books in the world, most widely read English books in the world, if you took everyone who had ever read the book, it would still only represent about, I think, 3.4% of the world population.
Now, if you took everyone who started reading the book and dropped out somewhere midway
through. Okay,
that'd
be probably closer to 10% of the world's population. The point is that success is a relative thing. And I find in terms of my objectives in my life that I would much rather reach a few people with something that touched them and moved them than to try to pander to a lot of people with something that is more bland and more general.
I once heard the information/media age that we are now in described as this. It used to be everyone was famous for 15 minutes. Now everyone is famous to 15 people.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting analysis. My experience in terms of the Yuntide project here, it's actually a good day to talk about this because the physical books, the cases of this first Eventide book, it just arrived at my home today. And my wife and I are in the process of our little cottage industry here in my garage of slapping labels on mailers and signing each of these books, numbering each one of these books by hand. We do them ourselves. And then carting them down to the post office so that they can go out into the world and reach the subscribers of our book. But it's the interesting thing for me has been that it has proven to be not only a worthwhile journey for us and for the people who subscribe to the book, but it also turned out to be a pleasantly profitable venture as well.
Is it difficult thinking in different number terms, though? Because, I mean, you've been a New York Times bestseller. You're used to millions of books being sold, I would imagine, or at least tens of thousands. I don't know how many. I honestly have no idea what the circulation is to be a New York Times bestseller.
It's about 6 million in terms of the Dragonlance books worldwide. I'm grateful for that. But as I said, I think in our interview before, I couldn't find a publisher who would publish this book because it was a charming book. It was a gentle book. It was a book that had something pleasant to say to people and was a pleasant place for them to go. And it wasn't filled with angst and anger necessarily, but was more of a pleasant tale, something you could read to your children and feel good about. And not where publishing is. Publishing believes that they have to shout louder than everybody else. And you can't outshout the media now. You cannot do it. You can't shout down the internet. You can't shout down media. What you have to do, I think, is to reach out and affect those lives of people who you can touch and you can reach. And the people who have come into Eventide, we're coming to the end of the Eventide journey right now because, of course, we're shipping the books, which is the culminating event of that particular book. We do have our second book that we're doing next year, Blackshore, in the series. But it has been interesting for us to see the sadness that people are feeling online at the journey coming to an end. Because they not only enjoyed the book, they not only have enjoyed the story, but they've enjoyed taking the journey of creating the story along with us. And that's made it a much more endearing thing, I think, and more meaningful thing for all of us.
You find it to be more meaningful, even though you may not have the same success level copy-wise, is the end result and how you feel when you sit down in your chair at night. Do you feel better about this experience? Does it mean more to you?
Yes, absolutely. It means more to me. And it's a more intimate, more personal experience. It's allowed me to say things about the human condition that I could not otherwise say. Now, I'm in the middle currently of writing the second book in the Dracus series, which is an excellent series and a wonderful book. And I'm very much enjoying the writing of that as well. But I think I am in some ways more proud of this gentle rebellion that we've done in Eventide and in the Dragonborn series, simply because it was a way for me to stand up and say, we've got to stop the madness. We have to stop the hatred. We have to start dealing with each other in a more kind way. And so, yeah, I think it's in that sense, it's become far more meaningful to me. It's more meaningful to the reader as well, because, I mean, there are only 500 copies of this book in existence. And the 500 people who end up holding this book and owning this book will have something truly rare.
I asked before about the price point, because it seemed like quite a bit for a book. If you would have found a way to make it, say, half the price, say, in the 20s or so, do you think you would have had more takers? Do you think it would have been 1,000 copies of the book versus 500? And is that something you would want to do?
Well, I mean, we are taking this book around to publishers still, now that it's in press. And for that matter, I'm looking into just go ahead. If I can't find a publisher who's interested in doing it, we can do a mass edition over at Lulu, and we can do it as POD Press. Then you are talking a book that's price point around $20, and that's far more accessible maybe to some people. But these 500 are going to have something that's special. Not only do they have the book, but they also have the journey that we've all shared together in the creation of this book, because we've included the fans and the subscribers very much on that journey.
Well, I have character traits that I've ripped off from Edvard to add to my bard in our current D&D game.
And let me talk for a minute to what I think this means for us as consumers. Well, I myself am obviously not a large RPG publisher, but I am privy to a lot of the conversations that go on amongst the industry individuals that give me a sense of what is going on out there. The basic thing is, as we've been talking about, they know the old model is not panning out, and they are fishing for a new model. And this is where I see all of this impacting the hobbies that we love, whether it's prose, whether it's role-playing games, whether it's any of this. And there are many different models and approaches that are being tossed around, that are being tested, that are being tried out, accepted, derided, whatever. And one of them is the model that Tracy's gone after, which we've been talking, which is the patronage model. The idea that you have a smaller number of fans who may pay a higher premium, but in return get a better level of service or a better connection to the source than what you've had in traditional entertainment. Of course, some people are going the reverse way of saying, well, maybe we do loss leaders. We give away something for free, or we give away the core for free and then you pay for the add-ons. Or there's all these things being experimented with. And that's why this is such an exciting time for consumers, because of the fact that we have this chance through our dollars, through the things that we build, the things that we consume, to decide, you know, what all this looks like for years to come. And this is a very unanswered question, which is why I really wanted to bring Tracy back on to talk about this again, because he took a stab into this. And the way this stab pans out, this is another vote in terms of the way the future looks, in terms of how this all ends up. When some historians writing how we went from books sold in bookstores to wherever it is we are in future land, these are the steps that were taken along the way to get there. Maybe some of these are going to be missteps and dead ends, but some of these are themselves going to be success, or at least going to inspire whatever is the final idea that sticks until eventually it evolves into something else.
Absolutely. And we have to keep trying different things and trying new things. That we've had success with the Eventide books, and that they've turned out as beautifully as they have. Like I said, the books came in today, and I couldn't be happier with the look and the feel of these books. We were able to craft the cover for this book. And this is an example of the kind of subtle change that happens in this kind of a world. We were able to craft the cover for this book without the back being chock full of sales text or quotations. The cover on the back is very simple continuation of the front cover, and it's all art. So that when you're holding the book and people are looking at this book, it is a beautiful thing to look at, as opposed to something that has to scream "buy me" from a bookshelf.
What if they made books like that?
Books that had
these sort of clone mouth and throats on them, and they scream like "buy me, buy," and the other one's like, "don't buy that one, buy me. I've got teen angst.
I've got a dragon on my cover.
I'm a dragon."
I do want to say one other thing about Eventide and Dragonspard. Because we had such a good response in our subscriptions, we were able to print some additional books over and above our subscription. And so one of the things that we're doing right now is we're offering a holiday gift package where people can purchase a package. Not only do they get the signed and numbered copy of the first book, the Eventide book, but it also comes with a subscription for the second book, which will also be sent to them. And that's available online, and they can come to dragonsbard.com and find the offer that's there. But I'd like to do something special for the Fear of the Boot people. So I'd like to provide them with a Fear the Holiday Boot.
Be Fear the Stocking like in this particular case.
Yeah, but that's available, that holiday gift package. If any of your readers are interested, we're going to give them a really nice discount.
That's awesome, Tracy. We'd really appreciate that.
That's great.
What I'll be sure to do is I'll be sure to take that information. I'll get that from you via email, and I'll put that in the show notes so people can go out there and take advantage of that. And there are, am I correct, a limited number of these. This is not...
Yeah, it's really a very limited number. We only had a certain number that were printed, overprinted above our subscription number.
Right.
But we'd like to give people the opportunity to get into the series. You know, you come into the second book, come into the third book, they'll be great books. But if you want the full collection, this is probably the best way to do this. For the holiday, we have the Eventide book at $78. The Blackshore Early Subscription, that's for the second book in the series, that's at $45. Both of those are plus shipping and handling kind of thing. But the holiday package with both together is $98 plus the shipping. And if you apply the discount code, which we're going to give you, that's Fear the Elf, all one word, Fear the Elf, at the URL that's provided in the show notes, then you can get $5 off on any of those packages.
If anyone wants to take advantage of that for the holidays, be sure to get out there and do that before those are all sold out. All right, so let's talk an RPG advice topic here. And Tracy, I think this is something as a prose writer you might have an interesting perspective on. And so this is a conversation. We've got a bunch of talking points, but I'd love to draw you into this as well. And Chris, it's good to have you back for an episode here to talk with us. And am I correct that barring any major issues, that you will be back joining us more or less permanently again?
You are correct, sir. That's the that looks like to be the plan. So, yeah, it does. It feels very good to be back, sitting back in the booth here. And it's nice and comfy and feels good.
And your Skype quality is typically awful.
But your face is typically awful.
Thank you. So the topic that we want to talk about actually is one that Chad brought up, which is town building. Okay, so let's say you're running a game, and obviously at some point your party is going to go into a location, and especially if you are not using a pre-built setting, or you're using a setting that maybe has some highlight descriptions of a town, but what you're trying to do is really bring this place alive and make it matter to them. How do you go about doing that?
Put a dragon in it.
Or Batman.
Put Batman in it.
Put Batman on a dragon in it.
Let's be clear here. We're not talking about LARPing, right? We're not like building actual towns here.
Chad, someone sent you an article, and I want to be sure to credit the person.
Oh, hold on.
So can you, all right, well, while you're getting me a name, I'm going to describe what they sent, and I will link this article from the show notes.
A really cool article. I was flipping through it.
But someone sent an article on the demographics of the medieval world. If you have a town that has this much population, it's this many people for a square mile.
Mystery Cycle.
That would be Devin Parker and his Mystery Cycle. Mystery Cycle.
Okay. So I want to be sure.
So thanks, Devin. I really like that article. Yeah. I'm going to read it in detail.
And it talks about how, and once again, we just got this tweet. We were just twat this.
Yes.
And so we...
All over us.
We've not had a chance to read it, but it talks about the detailed demographics of understanding exactly what the composition was of a medieval town.
Yeah, and the article goes into, like, if you're a developed medieval kingdom, for every X number of square miles you have X number of people living in that area, up to this many for a densely populated area. If your kingdom is this big and has this many people, you have a university, but that's continent-wide. And if you have a major developed city, you are going to have a major developed city that is going to have this many people. And if you have this many people and it's a major developed city, it gives a list of you're going to have this many blacksmiths and this many innkeepers and this many map makers and this many this. You're going to have this many constables who are maintaining the law.
Right. You know, that's great for numbers and details and everything behind the scenes. Doesn't make the town interesting, though.
Well, no, it doesn't. But it makes it more realistic.
I give you just a little bit of perspective, if I may.
Go ahead.
there's a place in Fellowship of the Ring, J.R.R. Tolkien's first book in the trilogy, where they're at Bilbo's party, and the firework of the dragon roars over their heads. It says in the text that it roared over them with the sound of a freight train. Now, many people have speculated that this tells us a great deal about the economy of the Shire and, in fact, what some of its import-export nature was. Just the other day, I was writing a chapter in the Dracus book, and I've got my heroes. They're standing around, looking around the town, and I realized that I've got all these people in this town, this crowded street scene with all these people in this town, and none of these people were doing anything. I mean, who is feeding these people? How are they getting food into this town? I mean, did they hunt? Did they have farms? I mean, is it dangerous here?
Yeah, I think it's so easy in a role-playing game, a book, and anything to paint a town. Like the players come into a town and you say, there's all these people and they're all this, and they're just kind of
milling about.
Well, I wouldn't say milling about because that would be boring, but they're just being social. And there's no work being done. There's none of that.
I never took that tactic. Well, of course, a lot of it depended upon the time that the characters entered town. But for me, it was always very obvious. If they entered in during the daytime hours, the only people that would be in the inn or the tavern or the place where they would logically go to try and find out what the heck's going on in town, the only people that would be there would be either the very old or somebody passing through. And that no one who actually lived in the town, who frequented this place, would show up until the evening after the sun had gone down.
But no, that's a good point. But let's not just narrow this down to the Middle Ages. I mean, you could be running a game that's set in the modern day or set in the far future. And I think the place where I would start with this, and you guys have hit on an excellent point that I want to come right back to, but I think the very first place I would start with is, you as a game master, as a storyteller, whatever role you are filling, have to first start by asking what the purpose of that town is within the broader scheme, what's going on. Is this just meant to be a place where they just resupply and then get their quest from the Color Animal Inn before rolling on? Or is this a place where they are really meant to spend some time to get involved in the politics, to interact with people? Is this a place that's really supposed to come alive?
The difficulty
of this in an RPG is the fact that the players may not always agree with that intention.
Right.
They may latch onto something or blow past something that you wanted to be more vibrant than it was.
Well, and I think that it's a matter of how you dress it up. I have all of this story and I have all this stuff and all these encounters planned out, and none of that takes place in this town, but they kind of need to sell their stuff, or they need to rest the horses, or they need to spend the night before going on to that. And they just kind of want to hand wave that. You should put at least something in there, even if it's background, even if they don't latch onto it. Wayne went into a shop in our most recent game. He went into a shop. All he was doing was going into a shop to buy something, and then he was going to leave.
A hat.
Buy a hat,
not leave a hat.
Yeah. Well, he left the hat somewhere.
Though there was a buy
else.
A hat, leave a hat jar up front.
Yes. So I had the front window of the shop broken in, and there was a very stern woman who was there who was selling the hats, and she was very nice to Wayne, and she was very stern to the little boy who was sweeping up the broken glass who was broken onto the inside. Wayne never asked about the character, never asked about the broken glass, never interacted with it. I never made a big deal about it, but it was there.
Mm-hmm.
Did that affect Wayne? Did it affect the story? Did it make the scene more real? I don't know, but it made it more real to me, and there was this sort of implied story there.
There was something going on that didn't have anything to do with the characters.
Yeah.
I mean,
he walked into something that was already existing.
Yes.
Yep.
And to me, that's what we're trying to, it's not about, I mean, that article is really interesting about the demographics, and I have a hard time saying how many people a medieval city should have, so that would help me, but it's not really about, is this your questing hub, or is this something that is going to have a lot of stuff? It's about whenever the players walk into something that isn't out a field. It is a town. It is a city. It's a space station. It's a ship. It's a city where they live in. It's a bar that they go to when they're hunting vampires or whatever. It's trying to make it more real to them. And it doesn't have to scream. It doesn't have to be 100% demographically correct. It doesn't have to scream at them and be a main center of a plot. But I think it's very important for a game master to add these little touches that breathe life into going in and buying something and walking out and leaving.
It's not just the game master who can do that either. Mm-hmm. A really good player can do that. And it's one of the things that we advise people in our XDM book to do. I was playing a game once, and don't you hate it when people say that? Like, you wonder, you just cringe. Maybe you should hide right. when they start with something like that. But I walked into it. I was in a tavern in a town.
And Batman was
in a town where I walked in and I sat down, and I supposedly had come from this town years ago. That was the backstory that I had. Mm. So I sat down, and the innkeeper came up, of course, to get our drink order, because that's what innkeepers do. Mm. And I kicked back in my chair in this inn. I said, Jonas, how are you?
I love it. I love it when players do that.
Well, I'm fine. Thank you. What can I get you to? I said, do you remember me? You know, and is your daughter still in town? You can pull that beautiful life-breathing detail and depth into a game just by bringing that sort of thing in. I think it's critical. I think it's beautiful when what you were talking about was a beautiful thing that you did. It is true that the players may never, ever, ever get a lecture from the town mayor about the town's demographics. Mm-hmm. But it's important for the DM, I think, to have not a detailed knowledge of it, but a sense of it.
Yeah.
So that it colors everything that you do and allows for those moments breathing life into the game and into the setting.
I see it like special effects in a movie, how special effects should be. Mm-hmm. Special effects should
the best
not...
ones are the ones you don't notice. Yeah,
the special effects that are good in a movie are not Avatar or Back to the Future in its time and that sort of thing, or Star Wars, where it's wow, where you're sitting there going, this is so cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has its place, but to me, the best special effects that I've ever seen was in Forrest Gump, because Gary Sinise, the actor who played Lieutenant Dan, he had two legs.
Yeah.
That's part of the story, but as you watch the movie, it draws you in, and you never really sit there. I mean, I'm sure some people are going to be like, I sure did. I knew he had two legs because I'm this crazy movie guy. But, you know, the normal movie patron is sitting there, and they're so drawn into the story, and the special effects are so subtle, and they're so good, and they're so well-placed that you think, well, that's Lieutenant Dan, and poor Lieutenant Dan got his legs blown off in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And you go with that. And you never think about it.
You look at that great firefight sequence that was in that movie. And yeah, it's all special effect. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't special effect as in screaming, look, I'm special effect. It was special effect in, oh man, this was what it was like.
Yeah.
This is awful. Mm-hmm. This is horrific. This is terrifying. Which is a very different thing. It's an entirely different animal from, wow, that was cool. Wow, that's a good effect.
I think that one of the things that you can do as a GM to kind of achieve this effect is the implied story. And going back, because I'm really egotistical like this, but going back to my window example with Wayne and the hat shop, there was an implied story there. There was this story that there was a little boy and he threw a rock through a window and he got caught and he had to clean it up. That was the implied story that was never told.
Let's even move away from your game to some cultural references, which is... You can look at games like Fallout 3 and now New Vegas. You can look at games like pretty much anything put out by Valve.
Yes, they are masters of implied
Portal,
story.
Left 4 Dead 2. All this stuff. Yeah. You walk into a room and there is something there in the room that makes you ask, what happened here? Mm-hmm. But it's not part of the plot. But it's just something that gives you a sense that this town has an object permanence.
Yeah.
It's not something that only exists when you're looking at it or you're walking through it. This is a place that has a story before you, has a story after you, and has a story apart from you. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this always has to be big things.
No, it doesn't.
One of the coolest things in Fallout 3 for me, and I think I've even said this before, is at one point there is a wedding in the game. Your character doesn't have to be there for it. Mm-hmm. If everything's panned out, that's going to happen. Whether you're there or not, you may never see it, you may see it. It has nothing to do with you whatsoever. You know, if I were to come into a town or a role-playing game and there's a wedding going on somewhere, that's kind of a slice of life. That's something that's going on in the town. It's going to happen whether I'm there or not, and has nothing to do with my story.
You know, actually, one thing related to what you were talking about, Chad, and this is something that I've done all the times when I've been GMing, because I think it helps add to that, because a lot of times players are going to go looking for things that you may or may not have prepared for. But for me, always having a list of readily accessible names and that I can just jot down a note that this, okay, I'm assigning this name to this person when they go in there. That, to me, helps to keep that realism going, because when they walk in there and they're like, okay, I'm going to go and see this guy here at the weapons shop, or this guy, the blacksmith, having that name right away, that makes it seem like, oh, I had notes and I had things planned out for this. And so they're walking into a part of the town or a part of the space station that does already really exist as far as they're concerned, because I was immediately there with an answer as to who this person is and what this person might be like. Just like with your story of the broken window, there's an implied story there. There's something already going on there, and that this is a real person worth talking to.
Do you guys think that it would be a problem, though? We'll take Wayne's wedding example. Not in Fallout 3, but in say, any game you can do. Modern, fantasy, which doesn't matter. You go into a town, and there's the big bad guy plot, and they're all doing whatever. And you decide to window dress up the town a little bit and have a wedding that's going on with or without the party.
Mm-hmm.
Can the players get too latched into that? Can they suddenly decide to get involved in the wedding and want to attend the wedding and want to be a part and get to know the couple and suddenly...
If they do, maybe you just add that into your plot.
What
do you do with that?
Yes, if it delays you a session from getting to the plot, you know, so what? I mean, as long as they eventually get there, then, you know, to me, I don't see much harm being done with that.
Well, as the only thing I could possibly see going wrong, because, I mean, on the surface, what you're describing is, oh, no, the players found something in my plot too interesting.
Yeah,
woe is me.
That's
a
great problem. But,
well, the only thing I could say, though, that might be an issue is if they latch on to it and you didn't intend for them to, and there's nothing behind the curtain.
Yeah,
there's no depth there, and you're not a good improv GM. Then you may be on a bad hook.
Well, let me give you an example of a problem that you had with this, Dan. One time, it comes from the story of the bookstore. We have a term in our group. Oh no, we've run into a bookstore. Dan was running a game. There was a space station. It was a futuristic campaign. I'm probably getting the details of this totally wrong.
It was
wrong,
a Transformers
but I don't
game,
care.
Actually. But
sure.
Yeah.
And so we go to the space station, and we're like, okay, well, what's there? And he didn't really have much. It was a space station where we're supposed to go from there to where the adventure was. And he starts describing the window dressing of it. You know, there's this and there's that and there's this, all the stuff you'd expect to find on a space station. And there's a bookstore and there's this and that. And they're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. There's a bookstore? Bookstore is knowledge. Knowledge is skills. And there's stuff we can learn. And we go to the bookstore. Yeah. And our thought process
bookstore must
was,
mean there's items I can pick up for character advancement.
Yeah.
Was well, how it fanned out.
Or research for plot advancement. Our thought processes as a group is Dan didn't put this in there for window dressing, which is what he had done, which is very good window dressing. But Dan put this in there because this is Chekhov's gun. This is where we're supposed to find information. And we latch onto it and we spend like an hour there. And Dan is very good at first in saying, you know, no, you don't find this. No, you find this little interesting thing. And oh, you find some more interesting thing. And I reveal a little bit of the lore to you and whatever.
Should have had something blow up outside.
To an hour or two later, looking at us and screaming, guys, it's just a freaking bookstore.
Yeah.
It's nothing more. You find the romance novel of the week. Let's get on with it. Is that a problem, or was that just like a one-time thing?
Has it been a problem in general? No.
Well, it gave you content for who knows how many episodes of the podcast.
It created a slang term for us of the bookstore. Because, in games thereafter, people would say, is this meaningful, or is this just a bookstore?
Right.
But beyond that, no, I don't think it was a problem. I think we were at a transition point in our gaming group where our games were getting deeper and more serious. And the idea that a bookstore could be just a bookstore was something we were just discovering for ourselves. But I don't think in general it is a problem. I think if you put something in the background, people take an interest in it. You have to have some ability to run with it. And some of that, I think, comes from improv. Another possibility is we've talked in the past with like NPCs, you can have little flashcards of NPCs, have a box of NPCs. We've talked about having a little box of flashcard plot points. So if you need little mini plots pop up somewhere, you can do the same thing with setting. You can have little setting events. A boy shattered a window and is there cleaning it up. That's something you could plug into pretty much any setting, any time period, any location, and would bring life to it. And I think there's a whole host of things that if you sit down someday and you can dig through your own life, you can dig through movies, books, just come up with these incidental background bits of culture, history, lore, a major monument, a holiday, a child causing mayhem. Mm-hmm. And there's these great plug and play setting elements you can stack up and just draw from as you need to bring life to a place. And Real Life Experience is a great book for getting this kind of stuff from.
Ah, yes. I don't know why in my head. A girl looks at you through the bookshelves and whispers to you, please help me. Oh, I like this bookstore.
Let's go to the stacks, baby. Well,
and then all of a sudden your gaming group is like whipping out guns, putting down a defensive pattern around her and saying, don't worry, ma'am, we'll save you. And she's like, no, I just need you to help me find War and Peace. It's on the top shelf. It's really comfy.
That would be great.
Yeah, that is awesome.
That would be awesome. So your characters are all sitting there with guns out. The cops are showing up. And she was just asking for help reaching a book.
Yes.
And that's outstanding.
See, yeah,
that is. It's perfect because you have to get the players to the point where they're a little bit more real and not expecting to set up a defensive perimeter in the bookstore.
Yeah.
They've got to have a little bit more sense about their surroundings than that, especially in a civilized place. So yeah, it's a great way to do that.
I think that most role-playing games tend to be on the unreal side. I mean, nobody wants to play accountant the spreadsheeting. So
Wayne.
Well, except Wayne. But
listen, I've played Traveler. I know all about that.
You play, not even in fantasy, but you play kind of fantastic characters. I mean, that even if the role-playing game is dark and really gritty and realistic.
Yeah, but if you don't have the contrast, it doesn't work. Yeah,
that's exactly my point, is that that contrast of the real, like these mundane, real things that happen that are not thick in your game, but sprinkled liberally throughout it, I think really help to contrast that. And for me, I think it's important to play to your strengths. If you're really good at setting, then you bring those liberal sprinklings you do are setting details. You describe what's going on, what it looks like, and all this in these details. For me, my strength is in people, is in characters. So I try and populate, I mean, the little boy and the stern woman, I try and populate my stories liberally with that, with these people. And a lot of times they get ignored and they get, you know.
I don't think they do, because even if we don't pursue them actively, it doesn't mean we didn't notice. It doesn't mean it didn't change the experience.
You're running a game for a group of self-indulgent characters.
Yeah.
Yes, we're not going to ask why the kid's cleaning up the glass and why the broken window's there.
Your character,
we as players are noticing it.
Yeah.
Our characters don't care.
You are role-playing character that you are more important than this situation.
Exactly.
If you didn't even notice that as a player, you wouldn't be role-playing that.
But yeah,
you just go in and get your hat and leave.
But that doesn't mean the players don't notice. It doesn't mean that doesn't change things. I had a guy who's really into movies once point out to me that sound and music are all but ubiquitously present in a movie. The way they accent a scene the most is not by the music. It's by stopping the music.
Yeah.
It's by, in fact, he told me that there was a technique that was at least used at one point. This conversation was several years ago, and I don't know if the technology's changed, but they would create an extremely low sound. It was so low in pitch the human ear can't perceive it, that they would lay over the audio track.
Is it a brown note?
Thank you, Chris. To guarantee that it was perfectly silent as a way of drawing your attention. And for someone who's not, you know, doesn't feel that creative or doesn't feel like they're good at improvising, go people watch. Sit in a mall.
Well, don't take your camera. Don't stare.
Yeah.
If you're looking at something for more than 5 to 10 seconds, you're creepy.
But unless you're Pat, who's very good at doing that.
But you know, go to some place like a mall. Even if you're just walking through work, you're walking through school, you're walking through a church, you're walking through whatever it is you do in your life, make notes of little things. Like the jackass with his eyes. But pay attention to all the little things that go on around you. You know, note all these little
and pay attention to.
Note all the little things that are going on around you. Note these little encounters. Note these little imperfections. Same thing with setting. Pay attention to what you see. If you see a little bit of peeling paint, if you see an unusually vibrant display, pay attention to all of that.
And I think you also need to keep in mind that everybody is coming from somewhere. Everyone is going to somewhere.
Yeah.
That they all have a past that shapes who they are, and that they all have an idea of where they're going and what the future is supposed to be. People are dynamic that way. Mm-hmm. They don't just, and when you meet them within the body of the game, sure, that it's just somebody you're passing on the street. But if you give them a sense that there is something more here than just passing somebody on the street, that they have come from somewhere and are going to somewhere, you know, you may not stop and talk to them, and we've said that here before, but it will color your perception of your surroundings, and it will give depth and breathe life into where you are.
In a certain sense, should also make that should help increase their level of paranoia or sense or lack thereof of safety. They're the recipients of people constantly staring at them for, you know, whatever reasons. You know, that's going to get them thinking. And you can really have a great time messing with your players doing that.
You know, I want to get back to something that Tracy brought up earlier about how the players can affect this life and this vibrancy in this town that isn't your main plot. You can do a little bit of improv where there's an understanding of, it's just like, okay, I give you an opening, and then you can play off of that. The player doesn't even have to do that. It doesn't even have to make assumptions, like the innkeeper comes over and say, oh, innkeeper Carlos, nice to meet you, I haven't been here in years, and blah, blah, blah. And it doesn't even have to be on that improv level, although that is great. It reminds me of something that one of our players, Jeff, did. What he did is you guys went into an inn, and it was a fairly, let's meet in an inn, let's talk about what we're going to do, let's leave the inn. And I had the barmaid come over and take the order as they are wont to do. And totally out of left field, unbeknownst to the players, he just starts ordering this crazy, crazy stuff. Like, it was like
pickle brine was the drink.
Yes, pickle brine to drink, and these hard-boiled eggs, and this. I don't even remember what it was, but it was just everyone at the table. All the players made these faces like, what is he doing?
It was cucumbers and pickle brine.
Cucumbers and pickle brine. And he was playing off of an aspect of his character, that his character was a little bit insane, and he was also from this far distant land, and that he was really paranoid. And the idea was, is if you don't order the steak and eggs for breakfast, but if you order cucumbers and pickle brine, the steak and eggs are going to be poisoned. No one's going to poison the pickle brine ahead of time. And he's this
May
weird...
I tell you what my response would be to that?
What's that?
That the barmaid would then nod, turn back to the back hall and say, Frankie, number five.
Well, it was great because I was able to take what he did, and I wasn't expecting it because he gave me this 38-page long character write-up that I certainly didn't read. And so it was all true to his character, and I was able to get some great reactions from the waitress, who I didn't have a personality for, and from that I was able to develop personality. These guys came back in a later game that Jeff wasn't in to the same bar with the same barmaid, and I was able to have an interaction because I remembered it. It was just some color stuff we had done. Is your friend back? We bought an extra barrel of pickle brine for him, and, you know, they were making jokes and stuff and back and forth. It was really great.
There's another point there I'd like to draw out, and this is something we hit on a lot in our last episode, is all things in their perspective. These are all tools in your toolbox.
Yes.
And I think the same thing is true of setting, that you can get the, to use an internet acronym, the TLDR, too long didn't read setting, where the GM just blahs on and on and on and on and on about everything. And I don't think that's necessary. Describing a boy sweeping up glass, describing a girl peeking between the shelves and asking for help, describing the fact that there's a little bit of a musty scent to the place and some water stains on the ceiling. These are things that add color and depth to a place that do not require 30 minutes of exposition to give.
Yeah. I don't want the inventory sheet of what's in the back room.
But at the same time, you can use that against the player. And we did that actually in Ravenloft intentionally.
How so?
Well, in the original Ravenloft, you go into the hall and there is a suit of armor in this niche. And the hall is dusty and everything's dirty and everything's dingy. But this suit of armor that is sitting here is beautifully polished and carefully cared for and oiled. And it sits there with its hands crossed in front of it on the hilt of a sword whose tip is pointing down at the floor. You go into this great detail about this suit of armor. And when people come into the hallway, they find the suit of armor and they would stop and, oh my gosh, the suit of armor. There must be something about the suit of armor. No, there's nothing about the suit of armor. We just took a lot of time describing it. They would then usually gravitate following the music that was playing in the game. They would gravitate into this banquet hall, and there's this table full of food that's described in careful detail. Nobody ever eats this food.
I do the same thing, only I do it to mine for ideas. And I'm going to reveal something to the players who are sitting in front of me for my current game. They go into this enemy encampment, and they find this general. The general is in very fine armor, and I describe it as very fine armor. I do a, sort of a good description of it, because he's the general, and he should have nice armor. And then they ask me, is it from this kingdom? I have no idea. No, it's not from this kingdom. Well, then that means it. And then they start saying, well, that means this, and that means this.
That means there must be another kingdom out there we don't know about.
You know what? You're right. There is.
That's right.
There is now another kingdom out there that you don't know about. And they start making all of these assumptions. And I'm there, like, taking these mental notes furiously, like, oh, yeah, man, they're told. Yeah. Oh, you got to watch out for that. And
something else I thought there is, an addition to mining your own life for ideas, I think you can also mine history for ideas, or even just the diversity of culture at your fingertips.
That's, I mean, it. You're fighting Hitler in the next game.
That's not exactly what I was getting at.
Oh, but I am.
You want to get some diverse looks for towns, whether they're medieval, modern, or futuristic. Start doing some searches on Google. Start looking up some images, because you might notice something in that picture that, wow, you know, I never would have described a town looking like this. Mm-hmm. But now that I have seen it, I could use this to kind of lay out the feel, the character of a place that they're going to go, a space station they're going to be on, a starship they're going to see, whatever it is appropriate to your game.
I've heard of people putting out actual pictures of architecture styles. There are arches that look like this, and they'll set a piece of paper down that actually has just a basic drawing of arches.
Yeah, the only recommendation I would give with that is, you put something down, don't leave it down. Because let's say you're trying to say, you guys walk into a cathedral, it looks something like this, and you put down a picture of a cathedral. If they get a glimpse of it and then you pull it away, they will have an impression of what the place looks like. You leave it down, they're going to start nitpicking the details, or getting lost in the details.
I'm of actually two minds on this. One mind is that on this old group I ran with, I would run a game and we'd make descriptions and stuff. And I actually had them email me pictures of the characters, not ones that they drew, but ones that they would find on Google and stuff to get as close as possible. Or this is the impression of my character. But I would also say, you know, you were in a castle and you were in this great dining hall and you were in this throne room and all this sort of stuff. And then I would send out sort of post game email pictures that I found on Google image search of, this is what it looked like and this is what I was getting at. And I think that really helped. Or before the game, I would send out pictures of, it's like,
I was
going to
say, that's the only thing I would criticize there, is after the game, it might add something, but I think it would do more to have it during or before the game.
Yeah, and I would do a lot during and before, too, but I'm also of this other mind of, I described this tower, and I described there was this sort of spirit spider in this tower, and I don't want to get into a big gaming story, but the inside of the room of the tower was all spun with webs, making it a sort of hollow cocoon within the room of the tower. And I had a certain vision in my mind of what it looked like. And then Pat describes, you know, months later, what he had seen in his mind. And I didn't go into hardly any detail whatsoever about what the webbing looked like. Pat is relating the story of what happened, and he is describing something that is totally different and unrelated to what I had in my mind. And that was because I didn't give him much detail. I didn't give anybody much detail. And I just said, it's this and this. And I planted those seeds and I allowed the imagination of the players to fill in those blanks where I didn't feel that I sufficiently could. And I think that if I had images and stuff, well, I put an image down on the table, even if I yank it away real quick, suddenly, that's what it is. That's the common shared experience of what it is. It will never be anything less than that. It will never be anything more than that. And when Pat describes,
I would disagree. I think it still could be less and more, even though you've seen it.
Well, I think over time it
gives everyone a baseline, and sometimes that's what I want. I want to be thinking of the same thing as the other players around the table. So we're having that shared experience.
But I also really agree with Alfred Hitchcock in that you don't show the kill, because not showing the kill makes it bigger in your mind. You don't show all the stuff. You just give the hints. You just give the seed. And then the person's imagination makes it so much more than you ever could. But
that's
like
the kill,
I said,
not the setting, though.
I mean. But like, well, I mean, the kill or the setting, I think you can do the same concepts can be done with the setting and the descriptions and the people. But like I said, I'm of two minds of this. And as a GM, think both are valid, and I think you should apply one kind one way and another kind another way, but I don't really know what the mathematical formula is for that.
Well, I don't know there is a mathematical formula. I think it's the art of DMing is what we're talking about here, yeah. Which is coming to an understanding of just how much to give to them and how much you expect them to give in return. I mean, as we've talked about last time, as a writer, I put down words on the page, but they don't live until somebody reads them. And the act of reading those words is where they create the reality of the experience. The same is true in a role-playing game in the sense that as the DM describes situation and so forth, it's the words that we use, but the reality of the situation is created in the heads of the player. And so it becomes a balancing act, a juggling act, and part of the artistry of refereeing a game and running a game to be able to know just how much to give them. Just how much description you need, just how much art do you need to place on the table in front of them, just how much image do you need to use, how much sound do you need to use, what kind of music are you going to use? This all becomes part of the performance art that being a referee is all about. And being a referee is very much a performance art. It's a performance that is done in conjunction with the players, a performance that is led to a certain extent by the referee. But the reality of the experience takes place in the mind, which is the realest experience, I think, that they can have in a game. It's nice to have miniatures, and it's nice to have models and so forth, and the visualness of it. But the real experience takes place in the mind, and that's part of the art and craft of refereeing, just finding that balance between how much you give and how much you expect the player to give.
Yeah.
Something else I think that can help to bring a town alive, and this may or may not always come up in the game, and so I don't know that's always worth belaboring when you're designing the game, is the fact that just as the town has a purpose to exist within your story, the characters are meant to discover or accomplish or live through something there, no matter how brief or long in nature. There's also a context for its existence within the world. Let me give you an example. The city we live in, St. Louis, it was put here because of the fact that it made a great place for trade and also for jumping off to the west. And it does so because of the fact that it sits at the confluence of several large rivers. And in the same way, every town, every hamlet, every space station that your players come across, it exists for a reason. Now, it may have outgrown that reason, same way St. Louis is now more than just a river town. The place may have evolved beyond that, but it did exist for a reason. It was not simply placed there at random with a bunch of randomly spawned villagers to populate it. And look at things like entertainment. How do the people there pass the time? Where do they live? What do they do for a living? How does this fit within the broader context of the governance that's around them or the culture or the economy that they fit to? And I realize, as I said, this may not be something you need to belabor with every town, but at least have one or two sentences on this because it may help you put a lot of the town into context.
Yeah, absolutely.
Last one I want to throw out here, discussion point, maps. Do they help or hurt?
From past experience when your games, Dan, when you used to be map heavy, they kind of hurt.
From past experience for me running them, I ran at Fear the Con. One game I didn't use one game I pulled out a simple sheet of paper and drew it, and the map helped intensely.
I was going to say, Chad, let me toss that back the other direction. Even in our current game, I think the lack of maps has hurt.
Yeah.
And I think the punchline here is both are true.
Yeah, totally.
That if you have a map that is too detailed, especially if that's
I don't want a map with latitude and longitude or something, but simply taking a sheet of paper and scratching something down, that's all I need sometimes, and it helps.
You need spatial order, especially if you are going to deal with the town in any level of detail. You need some kind of spatial order. And I realize that if you have a map down to the street level, that this can become a point of fixation for the GM, or can become a point of fixation for the players or whatever. But let's say you're doing a game that is going to occur purely within one city, deals in detail with its politics and its maneuvering and such. Well, you know what? Knowing exactly where this street lets out really could be a point that matters within the plot. Or even if that's not the level of detail you're going for, if the players are meant to hang out there for a while, knowing that this is what's on the north side of town, this is what's on the south side of town, and here's where the gates to the walls are, even if you don't have it down to the street, just sort of having a very rough bird's eye, here's where the big points of interest are, I think can help to give some kind of a spatial consistency to the place.
Well, I love MAP. I'm a huge MAP fan. I mean, I'm sitting here in my office this evening, and I'm looking up above my monitor here, and I have a big cork board. And the whole purpose of the cork board there is to hold the various maps that I create and build for the different stories that I'm telling. You have to have that relationship, or otherwise you have people who are traveling, you know, 2,000 leagues in an afternoon, and it no longer rings properly true. But I'm also looking, interestingly enough, on this board at a map of a town that I have, and we were talking about maps of towns. And this is a map of the town, but it's not labeled. There's no street labels here. There's not some mark that says you are here, king is over here, knights are over here, but just buildings. And I think that's kind of the sense of people have in their own towns. They look out across the town, and they're just buildings out there. Until you go and visit them, knock on the door, and go inside, they don't have any meaning beyond that. And so a map of the town, I think, can help really well, especially if it's unmarked. And, you know, they have to find their way through around this map. And maybe it's not as detailed as it should be.
That would help for consistency, too. If you have a map that's completely unmarked, they visit store number 3, you write down on the sheet of paper, hat store. Now they know... This is the store they visited. This is what it was. So you have the consistency thing next game. If they're right next door, you know that they're right next door to the hat store and they don't call you on it.
I remember years ago, I was living in St. George, Utah, and had volunteered to be a Santa Claus to take and deliver toys to families who needed help in the holidays to provide presents for their children. And the thing that I remember the most about it, beyond the gratitude of the people and the heart-wrenching experience of meeting those children and the joy that they felt in that moment, was the discovery of all of the places in my town that I did not know was there. All of the places where these people lived their lives that I had driven by every day and just simply did not consider what those lives would be. And it was like there were places in my own town that I lived in that suddenly came alive for me because I had to go there. And I think that's the reality of our lives, and that's a blindness that I think we all have to face and that we all have to deal with in terms of our lives. But it's also true in terms of these games that model life, that, you know, these towns can be vast and have all kinds of roofs in them, but that needs to be seen less of a restriction and more of a field of opportunity. Maybe that's the best way to look at a map.
I think this is a good place to wrap this one up. I do want to remind you guys once again that there will be stuff in the show notes. So if you're interested in that holiday special from Tracy, then that'll have everything you need to get out there to, you know, to use whatever codes and such you'll need to take advantage of that. Also, one quick parting shot here. Tracy, you are working on a holiday game.
That's right.
Available at reindeergamer.com.
That is my new website, reindeergamer.com.
I wonder if you real quick just tell us about that game. Tell us what you got going on out there. And then once again, this is a link I will also put in the show notes for anyone that's interested.
Yeah, and please do come over to reindeergamer.com and follow the links in the show notes, because we're giving away, free for download, a sample version of this game. You can download the whole thing and get the pieces out and play with it and push them around and everything.
And this is like it's a family board game for the holidays.
Yeah, it's a family board game for the holidays. Yeah, about 4 years ago, I was my wife and I were looking into that. We love games at the holidays. I love playing games with the family at the holidays. When are you going to pull out your Monopoly game and play with everybody and, you know, crush everyone? We were looking at, and we said, wouldn't it be great if you had like a holiday game, you know, something you'd play over the holidays that had a holiday theme kind of a thing. But there weren't any. And we thought, well, that was terrible. So we made up our own. And we actually, for the last 4 years, we've like given them to friends and family and for them to play in the holiday. And the game's called Santa's Sleigh Ride. Santa Claus has lost his Canadian sleigh driver's license. He's failed the eye test. It's tragedy, and he cannot drive the sleigh. Now, every elf at the North Pole wants a crack at driving Santa's sleigh. And so they have a contest to figure out who's going to drive the sleigh. And so we have this beautiful world map, and you're an elf, and you're trying to fly the sleigh around the world and deliver presents to the right houses around the world. And if you can take shortcuts across the board, there's actually a pretty good strategy element to it, but you can take your sleigh on shortcuts across the world. But if you take these shortcuts, you cross these reindeer spaces, and the reindeer don't like to take shortcuts, and so we have reindeer cards that they play reindeer games on you that can help you sometimes or hinder you, whichever. Anyways, it's just a lot of fun. It was a great family board game. We wanted a family board game for the holidays, and so we got Santa's Sleigh Ride. And so we looked for somebody to publish this game. We said, wow, you got the Santa Sleigh Ride game. You really ought to do this game because it's really great. Everybody want to play it at the holidays. And they said, no. So we decided, well, forget that then. And because we're all into online publishing, we've created this version of the game. And you can download the free sample version of the game, or you can buy the game. If you like the free sample version, you can come back and buy the game. And if you buy the game, I think it's like $18 plus change. You not only get the whole download for the whole game, but my charming wife and I will go out to our Santa's workshop and sign a full color washable board. Actually, they're really nice, big full color board, and we'll sign it and send it to you, and you can just play your elven heart to death all through the holidays with this and with your family. We just wanted to give something to somebody on the holidays that, you know, they could play with family and with something that wasn't Ravenloft board game or something.
All right, well, Tracy, I want to thank you for joining us again. And Chris, it feels good to have you back as well, even though you didn't talk a whole lot this episode.
I like it.
Yeah, makes editing easier.
Yeah, I do it again.
I appreciate that. So as for the rest of you guys, thank you for tuning in. Have a great week. Be sure to get out there also and check out FearTheCon.com. That obviously is still going on. And we will catch you guys next time.
See ya.
Later days. Bye-bye.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in a non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.